options activity has altered the investment landscape. Get an edge on this massive flow of funds with Tier 1 Alpha's Market Situation Report, brought to you by HedgEye, a daily newsletter of the latest moves in the options market and a weekly webcast featuring myself, Mike Green of Simplify Asset Management, and Tier 1 Alpha's Craig Peterson and David Pegler. Go to HedgEye.com/research for more information.
Welcome to the Weekly Notebook Review. I am Robert McGrory. This podcast takes on a bit of a different format, where we are live each week on Twitter Spaces. I crack open my notebook and review HedgEye research with anyone who wants to learn a better way to invest. We feature both HedgEye power users as well as some special guests that might pop in. If you want to learn more about our research, visit HedgEye.com. If you'd like to participate in the live stream, follow me on Twitter at HedgEyeRJM. Now, let's review the data.
Good afternoon to all. We'll let kind of the Spaces kick off here, then we'll get going, do a little bit of a shortened week WNR intro, and then hopefully Mike Taylor will be in the room and we can jump into an update from him. But let's give everybody a second here. All right. So welcome to another session of the Weekly Notebook Review. For those that are new, this happens every Wednesday. We really kind of go through the weekend work that we reviewed over the weekend and kind of how things, signals, portfolio positioning, stuff like that has adjusted from kind of weekend to midweek and how to best prepare the portfolio moving forward. So going into the back half of this week, next month, next quarter, et cetera, et cetera. So today's episode, we got a special guest, Mike Taylor, will be joining us here shortly. He just X'd that he will be in momentarily. But before we got Mike jumping on to kind of give an update and a rundown as to what he's seen out there, I just kind of want to go through a few signals. I think one of the biggest one on the page today is energy and the energy complex. You saw Keith McCullough, CEO and founder of HedgEye, reducing his sizing towards energy complex, specifically oil and energy-related equities like XLE, small caps, PSCE, et cetera, et cetera. So, that breakdown is happening. You can see it in the crude oil trade as of this morning. Trade level on crude was 86.62, and we finished at 83.772 is where we're currently trading. The day's not quite done on the futures at the moment, but I think that's a big thing to considering I was in Charlotte last week. We had a live notebook review with the folks there. But we didn't. So it's been about 2 weeks. And 2 weeks ago, energy was continuing to make higher highs and higher lows, and really had been a great place to have your capital and be really max position sizing. So in the course of the last week and a half, we've reduced that sizing. It's now at a minimum size position across the board in terms of energy related exposures. Did a build big tell there in the risk range this morning. For oil was that lower high of 93.39 versus yesterday was in the 95, just north or around $95. So a big lower high there. And again, that's kind of a good or one of many signs in terms of a weakening signal strength and one where you'd be wanting to reduce your overall exposure. Interestingly enough, on the flip side of that, you've got natty gas putting in a big higher high in the risk range at 3.53. So that signal strength is actually improving. Today, I ended up being kind of round tripped it really a little bit. Traded kind of like flat on the day, but if you were active this morning in natty gas, you could have picked up a really good price. So I think that's an interesting development here. We were actually adding to our uranium exposures and those have been kind of a top movers of ours. We're expressing that through URNM and URA. Not all of energy or kind of inflationary exposures are weakening in regards to signal strength, but certainly the energy related in regards to oil related, I should be more specific about that, oil related exposures, those have been reduced. And, keep an eye out on that, I guess. We've talked about that over the course of the last couple of weeks. It's been, it's picked up a lot of signal strength. I mean, it's basically moved from 280, 290 range all the way up to 340, around 340 today. So again, there could be a lot. You got winter coming up, a lot of other reasons why you may want to have some natty gas exposure. But for us, it's really just all about the signal and signal strength and the risk range, which from a trend standpoint is bullish. So I know Mike Taylor, welcome. Glad you could jump up, buddy.
Great in.
Just want to touch base. Yeah. Just want to touch base on one other thing, and I think it's going to be a good segue for you in terms of rates and yields in particular, right? U.S. yields, both the 30-year, 10-year, both had pretty big moves today, Mikey, in terms of, you know, down almost 2% on the 10-year, down 9.5 basis points, and the 30-year down 13, about 4 at the moment, trading around 4.70, down almost 2, a little over 2.25, or 2.75, percent. So kind of an interesting development there. Certainly that yield curve inversion went the other way, Mike.
Right.
As of just 2 days ago, I think we were yield curve inversion for the 10 minus 2s on the U.S. side of the house was around minus 30, I think, and now back down to minus 42. So kind of an interesting development there, from our perspective, Mike, and I know our system well. We keep seeing higher lows in the 30-year and the 10-year. And higher highs really over in terms of what's progressed over the last few weeks. So that top end of the risk range on the 10-year, we've got all the way up at 4.86 as of this morning. The low end down at 4.51. So we're pretty close to the low end of the risk range on the 10-year. I think it's going to be interesting. Obviously what transpires with CPI tomorrow, and how that flows through. So I know Mike, that's been a topic of interest and something that you've been certainly flagging and speaking about in terms of just bond market, 10-year, the elevated move index, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know if you have anything that you want to expand on there from the Fed or yield standpoint.
Well, so this is kind of like what's going on is kind of the Soros view on the flows and the mechanism that we think, hold on, I got to shut my office door so I don't get too much disruption. So the mechanisms that we used to think are going on are broken and in debt markets. And the big piece of that is sovereign debt. And I mean, you can see it, very out loud in your face in that the high yield has massively outperformed sovereign debt, all of it, U.S., whatever. And usually what would happen is that when you get such a move in the risk-free rate, it would apply more pressure to higher yielding assets, which really haven't moved. So the yields have gone up substantially on risk-free, but haven't moved in pretty much in high yield. And so that means that the spreads have tightened, meaning risk-free versus high risk. And it's actually pretty tight now. I think the spread is about 400 bips. And historically, you have at risk, depending on the market, you might have 1, 2% at risk during good times in high yield. And then in bad times, you'll have a heck up to 10% at risk, if not more, in high yield. And so what it's telling stocks, is that, wow, spreads are tightening. And so you get a feedback mechanism that spreads are tightening, therefore the economy must be great by stocks. And these are some of the classical feedback mechanisms that have been pushing in and holding up stocks. But and I know that it's only some stocks. And you can see it today what it was. It was mega cap tech. And that's all to buy near, near highs, while everything else is far, far away from highs. And when I say these mega cap names, we're talking about 10 names that have been driving it all. And so you have this wild crowding. I mean, crowding that's off the charts that I've never seen anything like this before. But look, the passive investor doesn't really know because they're just long indices and ETFs and the names that they know, which happens to be these names. And so whenever you see crowding like this, it is a great, great, great danger to things being unwound. And eventually it will be. But so far as the debt situation and where the risk-free rates are. What we're seeing the consequence of is M2 being negative, and the carry trade getting wiped out. And the carry trade is simply borrow on one spot or in another currency, and then buy the UST Treasury, and that has been wrecked with an inverted yield curve. Couple that with a bit of deglobalization, and that's also another pressure on yields. And then lastly, we have regional banks. And you can see it in the numbers. C&I lending is either just about to go negative sequentially or has gone negative sequentially. I have to go and update it to see exactly where it is. But these regional banks have about 28-29% of their book is exposed to commercial real estate, and that's as opposed to the money center banks that are 15-18% exposure. So they essentially have almost double the exposure, you know, 80% more exposure to commercial lending or commercial real estate, and they know how much trouble they're in over the next 2 years, and so they're collapsing their loan books in order to cash up. And when you're collapsing your loan book, you're slowing down loans. And that means that you have less money out there. And frequently that money would be also temporarily in a safety trade, which would be treasuries. When you issue loans in the short term before you finish the project, frequently be held in treasuries. And so these banks have been large buyers of treasuries. And that is diminishing, as evidenced by the auction today, which was terrible. And the banks got saddled with all of this paper from the Treasury. And so we have this bizarre situation on flows where we think that there should be a sort of like a market analysis and a market risk that goes into this. And, you know, we're selecting this versus stocks, the risk-free rate at over 5%. Or do we want to own stocks that have a much, much lower yield and therefore would be much higher risk? But they aren't thinking about that because I think the mechanism is broken. And there's no point to it being broken, by the way, meaning that, oh, this is bad, it's broken. No, it's always been broken. We just didn't know it. Now we're seeing the manifestation of the selection for risk-free assets before was largely a compounded carry trade. And that's in part what kept rates low, not the decision between stocks and bonds. So that's fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Meaning the truths are coming out. And we see this when the tide goes out, you find out who's not wearing pants.
Exactly. Exactly. Just along those lines, a good friend of mine texted this to me, wishing me to ask you, Mike, Bill Lester. Thanks for the question out there, buddy. And it could dovetail very nicely into what you're just referring to. But you know, his general question is kind of if treasury auction goes no bid, you know, go no bid. Again, it doesn't have to go all the way extreme. No bid isn't like no one's there, but just certainly, you know, less buyers than usual. How long does it take for before things get really ugly, or kind of, you know, what does that kind of mechanism really look like in your mind?
Well, the banks, the money center banks, and Ken Griffin now act as the intermediary to the Treasury, where these absolutely will be bought and then resold to investors. And what you saw here is that the investors weren't there and the banks swallowed the paper. Okay. So when I say a bad auction, that's what it means. That's what a bad auction looks like, is that the banks end up taking down this paper. Now they take it down with deposit money, right? And they have a lot of deposit money, the large banks. So it's kind of this game where, you know, on deposits, they're earning or they have to pay, let's say, 4%. And they are taking down this treasury paper at 5%, right? And so they get a spread. But they want to make more money than 1% every year on their paper, right? Yep. So this is not the business they want to be in. They want to offload this stuff to investors. Their banks make money not on lending, but they make money on transactions. They make a spread. They want to be market makers. That's where they make their money. And they want to be lean and mean, not with giant balance sheets making 1%. So it is their obligation to hold this crap. And this is part of the problem is that, you know, you look at, I mean, if you look out forward over the next 20 years and what this government and most governments have to put out there, I mean, you know, we're talking, what, over the next 10 years, an additional minimum $50 to $80 trillion of paper.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's really hard to swallow in a time when M2 is meaningfully negative. So we're going into a very, very difficult phase where European governments, Japanese governments, US governments have obligations out there that are, you know, $50 to $80 billion over the next decade. And there's not a plan to make this happen. And, you know, and I know that they can't cut spend, because if they do, especially in the case of the U.S., we will instantly be in a recession. So all of our GDP growth is government excess. So if you take away that government excess, we will instantly be in a meaningful recession. However, on the other side of that, just like what happened to China, is that the incremental dollar that the government spends is only delivering 90 cents of GDP. So you're now having these diminishing returns. And what do they call it? Minsky moments when these sort of things happen. So I will take note, though, today, so far as high yield and stuff, it looks like it's just a bounce on a technical on the way down. So I have to monitor this, because we've had, especially in the leveraged loan market, we've had a bizarre situation over the past 3 or so months where, you know, as things are rolling over, as pricing goes negative, leveraged loans have gone up. And I think that this is largely hedge funds that are capitulating and closing out their shorts. And high yield has held up, but leveraged loans, the riskiest of the risky, have actually gone up during this period of negative pricing since mid-year. So I think, but it's all going to be start to be found out around earnings. And this is new, what we've seen. I've never seen stocks, so many of them, go straight up, you know, for 2 years at two-year highs, right into earnings, and then blow the hell up on earnings. And it's just one after the other after the other. The last one was CarMax that just did it, where if you did any work, you could figure out that they have negative pricing power, they're going to have soft margins. Boom, right in your face after ripping, you know. And this is a matter, in my view, when I do the deductive analysis, it has to be that there is a lot of retail money in this market. Because usually the hedge funds would figure it out and start pressuring stocks into these events. And I think the hedge fund money has been drowned out by retail. And retail's only research and analysis is price action. If it's going up, buy. If it's going down, sell. And that's all they know. So I think it's a combination of a lot of retail in the markets, crowding. Hedge funds aren't helping, but this is explaining why so many stocks with obvious that where their companies are obviously faltering, not dropping until it's like a brick to your face, and then they crater. And it's the only deductive analysis I can come up with is it's retail that is pressing stocks, you know, because they all have a job, or at least they used to. That's falling apart right now as we speak. So
yeah, and the last time we spoke, you know, you and I talked a lot about, you know, pricing power, and there could be successful companies that do have the pricing power and those that don't, and therefore, you know, those are the ones to kind of hunt out on the short side. I want to come back to that, because I think, you know, folks listening in will want to kind of dive a little bit deeper into that. But just
on your bond auction today. So for those that didn't see it, at 1 o'clock you had the 10-year note auction. It came out at 4.61, and previous was 4.28. So, you know, big move there in terms of, you know, having just higher yields. And then tomorrow we got the 30-year bond auction tomorrow, same time, 1 o'clock. So that will come out. Previous was done at 4.345. So just kind of wanted to throw that on everybody's radar. And we've obviously got CPI in the morning at 8:30, along with some jobless claims as well. So the PPI this morning. Did you kind of pay? Obviously, you paid attention to it, Mike. But anything that kind of jumped out on you on the PPI front this morning, kind of, or the price action this morning? Obviously, you know, really, if you kind of look at the tape, the minutes, that the FOMC minutes that came out at 2 o'clock, want to read into it? Yeah, that certainly seems like it kind of lifted the market a bit. But who knows? You know, it was just it could have been many, many things. But obviously, that was something that the guys were honed on, was the 2 o'clock FOMC minutes this afternoon.
Well, we're at the crescendo moment, and the crescendo moment is when everyone says, oh, the Fed's finally going to start cutting at some point in the future, therefore I got to get long tech or whatever. But we've put in a lower high, lower low, lower high, lower low in everything pretty much. And the Qs are at the very top of that range right here. And we're either breaking out to a new high because the economy is accelerating and earnings are going to go up, or it's going to be a total shit show. And I think that's it. And so I pay attention right now to these inflation numbers, but I think it's, I think that it is the wrong thing to look at. Like on a daily and weekly basis, that's what everyone's looking at. But when you look out month, it's going to be about earnings. And I think that pricing has gone negative, and in many, many, many spaces, and we have a huge problem. Have any of you guys driven by an auto dealership lately? And I do, because I travel all over the country with my son.
Me too.
And yeah, I can't find a Ford dealership that isn't packed to the gills with inventory. And that's just one of them. GM's the same. You know, Stellantis, Dodge, Ram, all of them. All of them are just packed. And this is what I'm seeing. I mean, so I see negative pricing power, and we're hearing about it now ever since mid-year. It happened real quick. Pricing power has been the reason why we've had earnings growth this year entirely. And so when it goes out to sea, it's going to be very, very, very painful to P&Ls of the companies. And that's where I think we're on the cusp of everybody really seeing it, the beginning of it, the first inning of that. And so I do believe that, you know, the mode for inflation is lower, but it's not really going to go much lower until we have a jobs problem. And I believe that we have a jobs problem and nobody knows about it. And I'm going to tell you where it is. The gig economy.
Don't leave me in suspense, Mike. All right, sorry. You already delivered it.
The gig economy. And I don't mean DoorDash, and I don't mean Uber drivers. The gig economy are the millions of millennials that have started a one-person LLC and consulted to their five companies. And they would work for 3 to 5 month projects, and then they'll take off for 3 months and go travel. And they loved it because everything's deductible and they get top dollar because, you know, the labor markets were really tight. And that has ended. It has ended abruptly this summer. And I'll tell you why I know that it ended. I have a number of real estate investments all over the country, and many of them actually more local to me in New Jersey. So I'm involved with 60 units here in Jersey. And these aren't high end, they're kind of like middle end. And last month, September, a third of my rent roll was 2 weeks late into the month. and then 15% at 3 weeks. And we had to put eviction notices in for 7% of the properties. And that's before the student loans came. They come this month. Now, I was very strategic when I did these properties. None of my tenants have student loans because I knew that this would come back to bite everybody. So I was very selective. And then nationally, what I've seen in the multi-unit is a very quick decline in utilization where people are bunking up with each other. They're leaving their units. And so rental pricing power, it's twofold. Rent, everyone's like, oh, rent's going to go down then. That's great for inflation. Well, yes and no. Yes, and that rents are going to go down because the utilization is dropping. But you're also comping long-term renters, you know, who had a lower price from 3 years ago and they're exiting. Well, we have a lot of pricing power in that unit that they're getting out of. So you have all these amortizing renters that still have to catch up on price. So the mix is something different, but the incremental rents from a new property that you had that you rented last year, trying to rent it now, the rents are going to be lower. But a rent from 3 years ago versus now, the rent is going to be higher. So you have to go and try to figure out what that actual rent is going to be in the numbers. And I can't tell you. What I can tell you is that the gig economy came to a very hard stop. And this is what I was talking about with Keith a few weeks ago on pricing power, and that it's not picked up in the jobs numbers because these people are self-employed and it's millions of them, and their jobs, which were kind of sporadic, kind of when they wanted them in the past, you know, I do 3 or 4 jobs a year or something like that. Now it's getting spread out and you may not have work for 4 months and now you can't make the rent. And they didn't see it coming because they always thought they'd be able to call up their people and get an instant gig. And these are kind of like, you know, higher income individuals that are educated and tech savvy. And there's millions of them. And I think that that gig economy has slowed down dramatically. You don't see it in the jobless numbers because they are LLCs that are self-employed. So that's what I think is going on. And that's why we don't see it.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, we were certainly taking advantage of the 2% up move in REITs and other rate sensitive exposures like utilities that were up today. You know, those are the two leaders in the pack in terms of U.S. sectors today. I mean, the XLRE alone is up 6% last week, but still down, you know, 4% last month and 7.5% last 3 months. So still got a long ways to move. And this is to your point, you know, you mentioned kind of lower highs across many, many components, and that would, you know, REITs and UTEs would certainly fit that bill. And you know, yeah, to your point, I know REITs, I know XLRE is full of much more, you know, commercial real estate, but certainly office properties and stuff like that. It's kind of like the top holdings, but doesn't matter. REIT sensitivity, though, is really the key here, in my humble opinion.
I wanted it. Wow, look at Master. Okay. This is Louis Vuitton. What a total disaster.
What are you looking at? LVMH?
Yeah, LVMH.
What a disaster.
Well, hold on. I'm just pulling up a couple stocks here so I
can
see. Because I am watching, but it's kind of like I'm watching it all the time. All right. So
just while you pull those up, Mike, you know, for anybody that's listening to the end, if you got questions, by all means, you know, feel free to either, you know, jump up and ask to speak and or, you know, shoot a tweet out underneath the spaces, and I'll do my best to kind of scroll through those and answer them and ask Mike. Mike, yeah. Back to you. Ask Mike.
Only right 59% of the time. So don't forget that part. This has been a very, very difficult environment. And really part of it is why it's been difficult is that the moves are all happening very dramatically in very short periods of time. And otherwise acting as if nobody's there. And I mean, this has been the key attribute that I've noticed, though, is that it's a really easy book. If you know a company that has a problem, all right, and the stock goes down because they finally come out and say, we have a problem, you short the crap out of it then after it breaks. And that's like against every single thing that's in the hedge fund manager's mind. Okay. They don't do that. They're usually booking it then and moving on to the next. And that's not how it works now. You short what's down because the people that own this stuff is all retail at the incremental. And so when they see it going down, they sell it because they don't know why it's going down. You know, I mean, they'll go and find the news afterwards, but they don't anticipate anything. So the things that go down, like, don't stop going down. And that's what I'm seeing. And so it's actually a really, like, very easy way to manage it. And, like, if anything for me, one of the mistakes that I've made is that I have, you know, pitched shorts and such that haven't gone down yet. Because I really want to, you know, I wanted to be able to bring to our investors things that I think have deteriorating fundamentals, but nobody knows it yet. And that's the trade. But honestly, the trade is if it's down, short it. And that's it, because it just won't stop going down. And that's what I'm seeing across the board in every space. It's stunning.
Yes. It is certainly counterintuitive, right? In terms of, you know, typically when you see big moves down, you're like, well, how much more can it go? And to your point, you want to be positioned ahead of that so that you can capture that downside move. But, you know, certainly, the momentum really has been compounding either to the downside or to the upside.
I'll give you an example. CarMax. I had a little bit on because I thought the margins are going to be soft. I was bearishly positioned. And dropped 10%, and most hedge funds would be like, good, took it, book it. Wrong. I got five times the size after the fact. And I think it's just going to keep going down because their negative pricing issues are just starting.
Yeah, so I don't know if you follow, I think his name's Car Dealership Guy. Yeah, I retweeted, I think it was yesterday. He threw up a stat where $23,000 used to get you a 3-year-old used car. Now $23,000 gets you a 6-year-old used car. And that's just, I mean, again, from a CarMax standpoint, you know, they've had pricing power for the last, I'll call it 2 years, right?
Three years,
yeah. Yep. And it's to your point, this could be the beginning of something different.
Well, CarMax, their lots are full, okay, because they had too much high priced inventory, and so they got to unload it. And so because of that, they said this on the call, they're not going to the wholesale market auctions and buying anymore because they don't want any more inventory. But the problem with that is that means that one of the big buyers is gone at the wholesale market. And so what's going to happen is that wholesale market is going to continue to plummet. And now it just got a boost, and you're seeing that right now in the wholesale market. It got a boost because everyone was afraid of a big outage at the UAW, United Auto Workers Union. And all the, you know, OEMs would stop making cars. And so everyone kind of preempted that and bid car prices up at the wholesale market. Not a lot, by a couple percent, that's all. And it looks like that this hasn't happened. And so now they bought this inventory they got to sell. So I expect to see with CarMax out of it, I expect to see the next numbers in used cars is going to be down. So that's what I expect. I anticipate a very, very difficult time when you look at essentially everyone who bought a car over the past 3 years is underwater, and underwater badly. Some are horrifically badly, especially the banks that gave 120,
50% loan to value on these cars. And the collateral is worth a hell of a lot less than that loan. I mean, it literally makes sense for people to just default and just take my car and eat it. Goodbye. I'm going to go to the used car dealer and get that $30,000 car, you know, because the BMW that I massively overpaid for 3 years ago is now worth, you know, 60% less than I paid for it. And I'm so underwater that just take the keys. Good night. I'll take the hit on my credit. So then that's what we're seeing. Anyway, so I think that pricing is going to be decidedly negative, especially after, you know, 30 million people have to pay $400 a month or so on their student loans starting this month. And it is 30 million people. Almost all of them are 45 years old and under. So I expect to be an immediate, meaningful problem on qualifying for auto loans and buying cars. So pricing's going to go down. That's my view. And it's the same thing for Macy's. It's the same thing for Signet Jewelers. It's the same thing for Harley Davidson. These are companies that all keep debt on their own book, you know, in-house debt for these products that they will never repossess. Or a firm, right? You know, buy now, pay never. I think that's actually going to happen now. And you're going to see probably on this quarter or next quarter, you're going to see a problem. Remember, they won't tell us until it's 90 days. So, you know, and it just started now. So you may not see it in 4Q, but you will see it in 1Q because they're going to have to report that number. And these guys are, you know, they're slick douches. Okay. They could have a gigantic, they'll be like, yeah, they report the quarter. In fact, they'll even move the date of the quarter reporting. So it's just under that 90 days. So they don't have to tell us crap like that. They will do it so that they can do whatever it takes to get, buy them more time to dump their shares.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't want to telling you stuff that you already know, but certainly XRT retail in terms of the ETF has been a core short of ours for a long time, over 400 days. So it's been on there for a while. And yeah, it's been, again, it's like, and Brian McGough said the same thing almost every day on the call. I mean, his longs could be shorts and his shorts could, you know, some could go to zero. And there's a lot there that.
Yeah, I'll say it again. I have never seen so many stocks that are publicly traded companies that will go to zero in the next year to 18 months. It is astonishing how many. I've never seen anything like it.
I mean, I just pulled it. So I hadn't really looked at a firm in a while. I just picked that up. I can't believe it's trading up in the 30s again. Carvana, similarly. I mean, these things, Carvana yeah, went from 6 to 25-ish, I want to say. I mean, talk about a bounce. Anyway, yeah, there's a lot of garbage. And funny enough, Mike, I mean, I remember you and I talking in late 2020, I believe it was, when, and certainly early 21, where the garbage trade was on, right? And
you know it.
You talked about with Keith as well, the garbage trade. Now it's the opposite. These garbage, yeah, there's a lot that could go to zero.
Astonishing. And I mean, companies that are already down 90%.
I know.
You know, and they're going to go away. Like Lev, I just go through it. Like there's just so many, and a lot of them are SPACs. Literally 80% of SPACs are going to go away.
I hadn't thought about Hog in literally like probably 2.5 years when I traded it. But a firm on a 5-year chart, I mean, that thing peaked out at like the 160 range. It's now trading at $20. That's wild. David Ora asked a good question here, especially on some of these names like Affirm, Carvana that have high short interests. How do you think through positioning and trading around those, you know, when they are a bit call them hedge fund hotels or what have you, right? Cult names. And how do you think through kind of the price action and then, you know, and again, yeah. how to risk manage them?
Well, oh boy, that's a really good question. So I look at high yield and what high yield's going to do and what debt's going to do in order to give me an idea of if we're going to get a pan squeeze, you know, of stuff. I think we're at a moment now where that's probably not going to happen, where we're having the come to Jesus moment very soon, where the companies have to come out and tell us what's going on. And it's not clear that Nordstrom or Macy's is going to make it through this cycle. I mean, I don't think they will. Especially Macy's will not make it through this cycle.
You're lumping Nordstrom in there too? Do you think that's from a credit standpoint, like credit quality? You know, I mean, a huge portion of the Nordstrom business is obviously the financing side of things, like whether it be debit card.
When they, if these companies can no longer access credit markets to finance the purchase of their garbage, given their footprint, I mean, this is what's happening. This is MPW. MPW, for instance, and your guy, Simone, and I have worked on this for like 3 years. And it's really funny when the MPW is a different animal than like a Macy's. Like Macy's is actually running a business. These guys are just running a shell game. But the whole point is that it all ends when they can't get credit to run the shell game anymore. And Hogg is like that, and Macy's and, you know, Nordstrom, they are dependent upon credit working. And the argument for commercial real estate and Macy's and all these other things is, well, the Fed's going to see this and just hack rates down and everything will be fine. And I agree with them. They're totally right. But what has to happen between here and there is jobless claims have to go up substantially. And they don't see it going up because of the gig economy. So many millions of one-person LLCs that you don't see in the jobless data because their jobs are just getting spread further and further apart. So the Fed doesn't consider that. They only consider the data they have. And this is part of the reason why they're, you know, morons. But remember, their job isn't, you know, their job is to make the Treasury look solvent. That's it. Their job, and the other job is to get the White House reelected. And that those are the two jobs. So I don't think that the Fed is going to be able to come in and save the world before we dip our foot into the volcano. And look, just look at how many times that they did come in to save the world without us entering the volcano. Never. You know, we have a crisis first and then they react to it. And that's the narrative right now of everything being great because stocks are up in part and there's full employment and all that. That's part of the negative, is that part of the reason why stocks were up and they were up today is because, well, it's getting so bad that they're going to have to cut rates. And boy, is that just dumb. But that's okay. This is how it works. This is how it worked in 2000. This is how it worked in 07. It worked exactly like this in 07. Shit held up. Remember, they were cutting rates aggressively when the world was falling apart. So,
yeah.
And we're not even at that spot yet. We're far from it. It's an exciting moment. So I think right now for your investors out there managing, look, if I was a retail investor, I would absolutely not short stocks. Let's say, I don't want to say aggressively, do it as a hobby, okay? Be in a ton of cash and then, or treasury. Like I've just started buying the 2-year heavily. I had it on. I lost a little bit on it. I had taken it down. It had really tanked. And here at this level, I'm like, you know, when the economy falls apart the way I think it is, the whole world is going to turn around and start buying this because there's nothing to buy. And that's kind of like where I think the fundamentals will come into it, where there'll just be nothing to buy, nothing left to buy. And then they buy it. So I've been building my 2-year position up, and I am net, I'm probably about 55 to 60% net short right now in stocks. And I own, and I guess I'm vocal about this, I'm one of the largest shareholders in Pink, which is the fund that I manage. It's largely healthcare. And that's, you know, and that's, I think that trade is going to be successful, where short cyclicals, long healthcare selectively, and I do it through Pink and long 2-year. Now, that's an incredibly defensive book. And I realize that is a very dangerous book to have on, because if I'm wrong, I can lose a lot of money really fast. But that's what happens with running a hedge book. You can lose a lot of money really fast if you're totally freaking wrong. So I tell, you know, investors, if they ask, that's how I'm set up, but I wouldn't recommend it for the average individual who wants to learn how to trade or is engaged in trading. I would be, you know, cash heavy, I'm long healthcare, I'm long the 2-year, and effectively it's like you guys being long utes, okay? You're long utes, same thing.
Well, we're actually short utes, but yeah.
Oh, you are?
Okay. We're short rate sensitive. Utes are bearish trend. Same with.
Well, that's a different signal. I expect that this signal is going to turn in the next 3 months. And I know you'll get on it when the signal says get on it.
Completely.
And,
right now,
and exactly. You know, me, the idiot troglodyte. I will be a little bit early, a little bit wrong. And not sized. I mean, I'm pretty sized. I mean, look,
I think that's something that a lot of people need to understand, right? It's like you size it appropriately, for your portfolio, and you'll make a decision quickly if it starts to go against you. So I think that's a big thing. And it's very much, on brand for, you know, Agi and the way that Keith certainly operates and the rest of the team here. So, yeah, I mean, we have no problems. We're not married. You know, I know, like you, we're not married to any position, right? And they're just pieces of inventory, and we'll rotate in and out of them when the signal, you know, if we're long something like energy, you know, we started breakdown, and we took that down to a minimum size in the last few days. So that's so that's similar to you, right? Like if you think that. You know, you were on a few months ago saying that the 2-year could be, you know, good time. But again, you'll reduce that once it starts to, when the market changes and market dynamics do shift every day, every week, every month, every quarter, right? So, you do a good job like that. And I think that's something that anybody who's listening in, they really should reevaluate their rules and their position sizing, because it will help save you a lot of headaches, sleepless nights, et cetera, so definitely would highly recommend that. I think just where you did mention Pink there, Mike, the gentleman in Dog Dynasty, I believe he's a big Georgia Bulldog fan, so shout out to Dog Dynasty. He wanted to touch base on or ask you a question in regards to medical devices and GLPs. Why are investors not looking at the risk with GLP usage? And then is this, you know,
well, they
is this smoke or real
take thing? A look at Med tech has gotten absolutely obliterated in a way that I can't. I'm astonished how fast and how hard it has moved. We're talking 30, 40, 50% moves down for a lot of med tech names in a very short period of time, because the thesis is that people aren't going to have heart attacks. They're not going to need their knees replaced because of this GLP-1 class. And that is absolutely not going to be the case. But once again, it's price action, that's determining everybody's investment thesis. So if it's going down, sell it. And as so I believe that what we're seeing is an incredible number of retail investors invested in everything. And when it's going down, they sell it because they don't really know why. They hear a thesis, oh, GLP-1s. This is a weight loss class for the those that don't know. And there's been amazing data out of this weight loss class. It does reduce heart attacks. Today, there was a study that stopped early because it was successful, where these drugs improved kidney renal function for very advanced diabetics that are in a lot of trouble. And this was something I actually expected would happen. I didn't know it would come out a year early, but I did expect that to be the case. And I'm not involved in at least in the Pink Fund, to any material degree in these renal and diabetes companies. But the strange thing is what also moved down, you know, Intuitive Surgical. Intuitive Surgical has exposure of like 1% of their business to this. That's down, I don't know how much it's gone down in the past few weeks, but it's a lot. Hold on, I'll pull it up.
Sorry, which one?
Intuitive Surgical has gone from 350 to 281 today in about 2 months. And that's actually an outperformer. You know, Boston Scientific is largely tied to cardio treatments. Yep. And that one dropped 5% today on this news. So what you're seeing is a lot of stocks, especially in med tech, just getting wiped out that have no association to this. And I do think that the GLP-1 class is going to change the world, but it's not going to be material for a lot of these companies. But you're seeing the whole class get sold just because. So it is very difficult to navigate because I think what's being exposed right now is the kind of investors that are in here. It is investors that don't actually know the difference between one or the other.
Yeah, have you looked at IHI? Like what's inside of that? I haven't pulled that up in a while, but
yeah, and so basically like Goldman Sachs and others have made baskets of stuff so you can just short the GLP-1 negative affected class, and that's been perfect trade. And so what I think in part is happening is that you're having all these incremental sells to pressure things down, and there's just nobody on the other side. So it's really just back to what Mike Green has talked about so much, is that you think that there is actual markets underneath these stocks, and there aren't. You have passive flows that are blind and don't know and small. And then outside of that, if you actually have a real sell in anything, there's no buyer on the other side. But it goes the same way, is that if you have positive flows into groups, there's no seller on the other side. So this is in part why you're seeing these parabolic moves in today, med tech versus tech. You know, the spreads are literally like year to date, like, I don't know, like 70% spread.
Yeah. It's kind of,
yeah. I mean, it's wild. It's wild. And this is just it works both ways. So illiquid markets that don't have any depth to them, this is exactly what you see.
Yeah. So gentlemen just tweeted on Cigna. I think, I don't know, is that inside of Pink?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he was, Brian's wondering, kind of, can you clarify the position and seeing that due to their weight loss drug exposure?
Look, Cigna is an HMO, and the HMOs have very little material exposure, because if utilization of GLP-1s go up, yes, it costs more, but then they up their rates to charge more for next year. So, you know, so that's That's great.
That's good. Yeah, we can just stop there. Right. So
good. That's the nice thing about HMOs, and we have a large position in Cigna. I think that that's one of the most attractive HMOs. Now, what's interesting about it is it's actually underperformed versus like UNH. And the real reason, in my view, why it's underperformed is has a lot to do with benchmarking and sizing. And that UNH is the largest position in all the benchmarks. It's around 10% for most of them. And so, you know, when you have any active manager that wants to outperform the benchmark, they try to size, they're terrified of UNH. Because, you know, they can't be overweighted. So they buy every share they can. Like under mandates for most of them, they're not allowed to have a 10% weighting in their book. So they'll go to their max weighting that they're allowed in their book to get close to the index. And they are loath to sell it because they're terrified of underperforming that index. And that's what I think we've seen happen is that UNH has held up better than most of them. And it's just for that reason. It's not fundamentals. And we see a lot of this. I mean, this is part of the reason why all the tech stocks, that all the seven or eight tech stocks are up so much, is that everything else is not so good. This is left over, and they are the biggest components of the benchmark. So the passive money that goes into just an ETF, they don't actually go into an ETF. They create a synthetic ETF. And in that synthetic ETF, where it's mirroring the benchmark, they don't care about the stuff that's smaller weighting, meaning smaller companies. And so the money incrementally goes much more into the large caps than they do the mid caps. And that's what keeps dragging it up, up, up. And this is exactly what it looks like. Most people are unaware of these mechanics that are going on underneath the surface. But over the past 10 years, it has become extreme, very extreme. And this is part of the reason why, in my view, hedge fund performance has been crap, net-net. And it has been because that undiscovered diamond in the rough that's in the mid-cap arena, nobody ever finds it unless it's really hitting you in the face with a brick. Nobody finds it because the actual money that's going into everything isn't looking at that. They're only looking at allocation, and that allocation happens to be more into the larger caps than the smaller caps.
Yep.
It is a brutal phenomenon. It is outside of the dividend discount model. It is outside of everything that Warren Buffett does and did. And if you take a look at Warren Buffett's book, by the way, about 50% of his book is one name, Apple. Really? Really? That's what he's done. And it might be because he's seeing what is going to happen to these markets and has happened to these markets, and that the largest names can't go down until things get really bad and everything else will tank.
Yeah, I just pulled up, Mike. I mean, the Apple alone has 337 ETFs have Apple Inc. within its top 15 holdings.
Uh-huh.
So just that alone, I mean, just the passive flows, just flows in general, just flows are probably a big portion of the market. I mean, I think if you, yeah, it's quite crazy. It's not crazy. Excuse me. It's just reality. And so you have to adjust. You have to adjust for it. I mean, Amazon's 221 ETFs have it in the top 15 holdings. So again, it's just, and it's not just in things. You know, it's in everything from online retail, ONLN, which is a 24% weight, down to, you know, kind of small ones like T. Rowe Price Growth Stock, right? TGRW. It's a 7.55% weighting in there. So it's not just in your traditional things that you know, kind of like the XLY, et cetera, for Amazon.
And is that the best idea? No.
Right.
But that's where the money's going to go with certainty. And that's why they own it.
Yeah. For those at home, if you want to kind of track some, Invesco has RSP, which is the equal weight S&P 500. So you can just quickly, you can fill that on a watch list or whatever it gives you.
Yeah, and that's a disaster.
Yeah, last week it was negative. I think with today's closing pricing, it's up about 80 basis points on the year versus the S&P 500, which as of this morning, I haven't looked in year-to-date numbers, but rounded off.
Yeah.
So 14% year-to-date, right? So huge delta there between the equal weight and the SPY.
I will say the past 2 weeks that I've been at the racetrack, this is the first time it has happened. Many people have come up to me because they see me on these programs and stuff, mm-hmm. and they have asked me what to do with their stocks. And I ask them, well, what are you doing? And uniformly, they're selling the losers. That's it. They literally are like, yeah, but the tech stocks are still holding up, so we're good. And that's it. That's the analysis. That's it. So when they go down, every single one of these people are going to sell. It scares the shit out of me because there is no analysis that goes into it. It is just, it's a casino.
Yeah, so along those lines and where we've been talking about Apple and what have you, it's a perfect example in terms of just the consumer discretionary spending. Now, again, there's a lot of, it's a behemoth, a lot of different services components in there as well. But you mentioned earlier about pricing power. What's your view on Apple's price power? Or let me rephrase that. It doesn't have to be Apple. I think.
We could talk about Apple. Apple hasn't grown for years. Okay, it trades at 27 times forward. It doesn't grow. And when you do when you look at it versus the yield on that versus the risk-free yield, it doesn't make any sense that it's here. But it does if you simply view it through the lens of, well, bonds are down, so I'm selling that. And Apple's not, so I'm buying that. And I don't know what's going on with the company. And that's it. And that's why we see over the past 3 years, we've had millions of brand new retail accounts opened. And largely, they bought stocks. And you can see it in the holdings of stocks versus bonds. We are at all-time highs by a mile, just to the extremes in massively overweight stocks versus bonds. Just literally off the charts. So the probability of there being a meaningful correction the other way is unbelievably high.
Yep. No, I agree. So if we expand on that, again, I don't need picks per se, but where do you think, whether it be industries or what have you that have most ability of kind of pricing power per se, right? And then those where you see great risk. Again, we've already kind of talked about the used car industry, so maybe we'll skip that one and everybody can go do their own research on the used car industry. So let's maybe try to flip it a little bit to positive side.
Selective.
And then I do want to go to Jordan. So thanks.
It's very selective. Within tech, I think that you have. So it's getting confounded now. For instance, companies that have a lot of debt are now going down. And I am watching this. And big companies that have debt are dropping. And that tells me that everyone, real money, is actually worried about the rollover of this debt from lower rates to higher rates. For good reason, but that's big, big, big money. So I basically go in my book and I'm like, okay, these fundamentals are okay, but if they hold a lot of debt, like auto companies hold a shit ton of debt.
Ford,
and they've dropped about 35-40% off their highs in a pretty short period of time. Now, these things move around a lot, but it's been uniform. It's been uniform with the cable carriers and other things like that, where the fundamentals of the cable companies don't really matter. They just have a lot of debt. And so we're going to sell them. And that's it. And so what you're looking at is companies that have a low net debt position and are kind of like a GDP plus grower, or just in Apple's case, below GDP, and they don't care. So, and that's kind of like your long book. And then selectively, I own things like DraftKings, which is a share gainer, and that's a rental, because eventually the people are going to blow up in it. But they're such a big share gainer, and transitioning to a real EBITDA positive situation, that it's pretty compelling. So I'll own that. I own.
Yeah, that's on our investing ideas as well. DraftKings, DKMG.
I own Spotify and Warner Music also, and those are subscription based, but they hadn't taken pricing during this whole move, and they just recently took pricing. And yes, that will run into a millennial problem at some point, but it's going to be offset by pricing as compared to everything else, which I think is going to be in much worse shape. So just remember, I'm looking at this as a paired book. If my longs go down 20, but my shorts go down 25, I still make money. Okay, so I'm looking for that spread. Your investors, for the most part, 99% of them, are just looking at longs, absolute long return. And an absolute long return for this market, the way that it's positioned today, I would have sold every position I have. That's really it. Boy, it's a little depressing, but I'm sorry. When we go into crappy markets, even like your friend, who's your retail guy at Hedgeye? He's bright fella.
Oh, Brown McGough.
McGough said, even my longs are shorts. Yes, that's right. That's exactly what I'm getting at. Even my longs are shorts, and that's okay. You know, I've owned this plastics company, PureCycle PCT, and I'm sure we'll get questions on that. And I still own.
We've had it too, Mike. When I was glossing over them, because there's so much better value than just going back to PCT. You're so much more. And Keith said this the other day when you were in the studio. You're so much more than just one pick, right? So
it's like, yeah,
you know, come
yeah.
on, guys. No, let's move on. There's look, a lot of other stuff. But,
it's one yeah. that I think could be a 30, 40x return, all right? And those are very few. And we don't have to go into it, because they're at the kind of the 1 yard line I'm beginning to execute. And so, you know, if people can own it after the fact. I'm not one of those hedge fund guys that goes out there and just pumps names and gets all my buddies on board to run it up. That's not my bag. I don't do it, and I never want to do it, because I don't have to do it. It'll play out, but you know, it PCT, even though it's dropped, you know, what, 50% or so in the past couple of months. This is a small cap. This happens. I have a crap ton of shorts that are down 90% on the year, and probably going to zero. So I can still profit even when some of my best ideas are down 50%. Now, I will say, if it's down 90%, I'm going to have a hard time. But things that this is how my book is built, and it is a built book, and this is what I've done for 20 something years. So it is very, very different. I don't have a day job. This is my day job, that and racing. So, exactly. And I will tell you that, you know, Keith and I have some big plans for next year. No, we're not getting married, but we might. And
I love it.
And I'm toning down my race schedule by 50% next year. So, wow. To do a lot of work with Keith. So I am managing my book to get some things on the road, which I'm very excited about.
That's awesome.
But so I will be much more involved and much more active, probably from here out. I'm offloading my son onto the team and his coach and his mother. So
that's awesome.
Go out there and go in circles, and I'll just look at screens. Let's get to work.
Let's do it, baby. So listen, I know we're a little pushing past an hour here. Jordan, I'm going to come to you, but I do have just one last kind of question from my side for Mike around China, buddy. I know it's kind of
China.
It's caught a little bit of a bid here in the last couple, last week or so. It's bearish trend on the page from the Shanghai Composite on our risk range signals. I sat down with Felix Wong this morning for his first.
Can we give a little snapshot on that?
Yeah, China was great. I mean, our top three were Tencent, TCEHY, and kind of what the positive in the e-gaming space and what's transpiring in China there. The second was around MNSO, which is one of his favorite longs. And then the last component was just kind of like in sorting through the data that's coming in on CSE. In terms of, that's kind of still a very, I'd say, probably widely held name. And Felix has gone both long and short. Most recently, I believe it was short side on C. And that really was a fantastic call from him. The replay's up and available. Just kind of curious, if you're anywhere in China, if it can be a very simple no.
I am loath to trade China. Okay, and it's kind of like gold, right? Because gold is manipulated.
Which I know you trade super well, and you told me that.
I'm an idiot, all right? But, China is a manipulated market just like gold, right? And if you take a look at, just pull up the K-Web. The K-Web hasn't moved in 2 years. That one downdraft, it bounced back, and it hasn't moved in 2 years. Now, granted, net, it's down a lot over 3 years. All these, things are, but it hasn't moved, even though the economy has absolutely imploded in China. Look, China can just say, okay, well, we're going to just give the brokers more credit, and they'll walk in to hold up the market, and that's it. Japan does the same thing, by the way. By printing money and buying stocks. They're holding up assets. So, it is inflationary, but they don't really care because it's all about maintaining power amongst the people, right? It's all about, in Japan, it's about elections, sort of, and because they essentially have a single party. And in China, you have a single man. The data is fake, all of it. I just had a conversation. My daughter was very upset about this Israel-Palestine thing, and she wanted a synopsis in 3 minutes as to who's right, who's wrong, why. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I need 2,000 years to explain to you what has happened, because they've been trying to kill each other for 2,000 years. China, and I said, do you know that China has performed an ethnic cleansing of millions of individuals in northern China, where they separated the families and gave the wives to new Chinese people that are not of the undesired religion, and put all the men into re-education camps? Millions. No news on it, right? And I was like, well, there's a lot of reason why. There's tremendous interests that want to be involved in China, even though the company or the state produces fake numbers. And there's a lot of growth plans in China for Apple and all these other companies. And they happen to be huge ad sponsors to the media. They are the biggest: Apple, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Meta. These are all the big ad sponsors, and they don't want negative news on China. And so it doesn't get written. So you have millions of travesties going on in China, and it was never reported on. So, the news that you get and you see in front of your face is meant to enrage you. And it is frequently not the most important topic that's out there, because their job is to deliver clicks and enrage you so you keep clicking. And so we are all just hamsters on a stupid wheel. No, I'm not investing in China.
You forgot Tesla on that list, though. So, you know, maybe it's because we're on X right now.
So yeah, but Tesla, Tesla has a robot. They have a robot. They're robot. They're going to put it in a boring tunnel, and it's going to Mars.
It's driverless technology too. Your own AI.
Yeah, I got a chip in my head. Totally.
I see Jimmy out there, a little booster. I'm going to give him a little shout out. Jimmy runs money.
Don't get me started on this crap crypto stuff, okay?
Yeah, we won't go there. I'm going to finally get to Jordan, and then we're going to wrap up because it's. I'm sure after his question, we'll probably push an hour and a half. So, Mike, you're so generous with your time. It's always a pleasure. I have a blast talking to you. This is just like talking to a buddy over a pint. So always a good time,
man. We have
to Jordan.
A pint stand, okay?
Agreed.
I don't know Rich Farr. He wants to.
Holy shit, we got Rich Farr. Get him on.
No, not on here. But he wants to. We've been trying to get a time to for him to come in and chat with us. So maybe we'll do a little session. Do kind of a cat. Anyway, we'll figure it out. But I'll be in touch with you. Jordan. Pleasure. Thanks for your patience, buddy. How are you?
What do you got, Jordan?
And no problem. Thanks. You guys hear me?
Yep.
You can. Yes.
Thank you.
Now we can.
Now we can.
Oh, okay. All right. We're good. We're back, Jordan. There you go.
Yeah. So, quick question on Mike, would love to hear a little about your process for finding names. So, like how you came across PureCycle, for example. And then separately, looking at like facts in general, I'm trying to think about like how to research like which of those, like all out of all of them, like maybe some of them are real companies. And trying to figure out which ones maybe after this cycle to potentially invest in. But like there are a lot that are backed by private equity, like in the cap structure, it's like you're really diluted. So kind of a two-part question. How do you source ideas and think about your process? And then also like in terms of like SPACs, anything interesting there? Anyway, I'm just curious your thoughts.
For the most part, 90% of the SPACs are crap. So... And that's it. And frankly, for the most part, they've traded largely together. And that's why they have buckets of where you're just short 100 SPACs. And that's what hedge funds have done, is just short 100 SPACs, and they don't even know what's in there. And that's actually been a great trade. So that's not really a big deal. But my process to find stuff is that I am watching... I don't know how many stocks I got here. Probably, I don't know, 1,500 stocks on my screen right now. And they're all separated into groups, different, GIX code for the most part. I got HMOs, healthcare, tech names, story stocks. I have a special section for story stocks. These are largely retail-owned story stocks, and I got about 150 there. Cyclicals, consumer, brick-and-mortar consumer, hotel, gaming, and leisure, fins, REITs. And so I have, I'm watching all of it, and I'm listening and reading. I listen to a lot of conference calls, and I'm looking, usually I'm looking for something. I think that I don't know what the hell the automakers are going to say on this call. I'm just, oh my God. And then aside from that, I'm looking at things that don't make any sense. Right. And I will watch that for instance, NVIDIA. NVIDIA is playing an enormous amount of games. All right. And then I'll call all my buddies in tech. All right. And I'll say, so when are the comps going to destroy them? And the consensus is 2Q next year. That's when they blow up between here and 2Q, because they've been playing a lot of games, financing companies in order to buy their product, which is at a huge margin. And right now you have this situation of everyone buying product in order to build an AI product that nobody is really sure is going to yield a profit, but everyone feels compelled that they have to build it. So everyone has to buy from NVIDIA. And they marked everything up 100%, so they have great margins and on and on. But when does it comp out and they run into a problem?
it's 2Q next year. Now, the question is, does everyone figure it out before 2Q next year? And the probability is yes. So I now have that in the back of my head. And I know that it's then, probably. And so I will watch and talk and listen over and over and over. Watch, talk, listen. Watch, talk, listen. And that's usually how my ideas come about, is I'm setting up. Right now, I'm like setting up in my head for 100 different trades. Some are 6 months out. Some is a year out. Some are now. But every trade that I have on now, for the most part, I've been working on for months, if not years, some of them. So it's really like watching a soap opera. And that's what I'm trying to figure out. And I, you know, a lot of things that I'm doing work on are not going to be actionable. Like right now, what I really have to do work on is med tech, because med tech has gotten annihilated. And what I want to know is, when is everyone going to figure out that it's not, as this GLP-1 eliminating all diseases is not actually true? For some, it is. It's going to be a problem. But for most of them, it's not. And I'll bring up one like Intuitive Surgical. Intuitive Surgical has gotten, let's say, mauled 25-30% off its highs, because 2% of their business is lap bands. It's a band that goes around the gut to reduce your eating. And you say, oh, we just take a GLP-1. You don't need to do this anymore. I'm like, okay. So they lose half of their business there. That's a 1% hit to the revenue line. This grows at about 16% procedure growth a year with no new machines, robots, that is. And I'm like, they may not even see that decline. But the stock's gotten whacked anyway. Now, what if they come out with a new robot next year? It'll be their first new robot in many years. Wow. That would be huge. So I'm doing work on exactly that. And when they're going to figure this out, that this is a huge long idea while they're selling it. And I don't know exactly when it is. But I'm going to find out and figure it out. And those are the things that I kind of work on. And that's my process, is that I'm working on 100 different things, and then I narrow it down to 50. And then I try to figure out when is going to be that moment of trade. And I don't get it at the very bottom. I don't get the short at the very top. I'll try to get it for that big move in the middle. And ideally, I can find 40 to 50% movers. In the case of PCT, that's a different one that I rarely do. I rarely have a high conviction small cap that I think is a 30x return. So that is more just like, I mean, I'm working really hard on that too, figuring out exactly when they're going to deliver that carded product out to turn this into a, you know, basically a story into an execution story, where the you know, the process is validated, and now it's all about how big can this be. That's a much easier story, by the way, and that's when everyone else is going to get involved, when they start to figure out how big this can be. Anyway, so that's my process in a nutshell. I hope that helps, but I listen a lot to a lot of calls, and I take notes longhand in a laboratory notebook. And I write down notes of every phone call I have, every stock that I talk about. I literally write down my notes so I can go back and say, what was I thinking? What were we doing? And I go back by date. It's a full-time job.
Yeah. Mike, I mean, that was super helpful. Yeah, Jordan, I think, again, I mean, just to piggyback off of Mike here, I mean, if you see big themes, like industry-wide themes, like, for instance, you know, just in terms of ISRG there, right? It's been hit from the it's been hit, but, like, you know, can they come out with a new device or a new piece of equipment, et cetera, right? So kind of these themes that are transpiring within the industry, you know, whether it be streaming services, like, and kind of parks and stuff like that, like a Disney, right? Again, I'm just using that as an example, or other general kind of electrifying of cars or what have you, a number of years ago, right? Like, you know, these type of big themes
There's broadband, spectrum broadband, a wireless broadband that's going to become available from the government. You know, how could that possibly impact things like, you know, T-Mobile or Verizon, you know, stuff like that? I think, you know, that's one, I wouldn't say easy way, but one that you can do some work on your own and you can kind of look through these bigger industry wide kind of themes and then try to figure out who might be winners and who might be losers, right? So I know Rob Simone jumped up. I don't know if he had commentary around that as well, but that was certainly something that I used to do in equity, you know, when I was a...
Wait, is Rob Simone on this call?
He is. He just jumped up.
Yeah. Hey, guys. We've got
to get Rob on there. See, it's going over now.
Hey, what's going on, guys? Hey, Mike. Hey,
so, tell me, Rob, and it's not like people think that I conspire with you, you know, for this MPW thing. and it's not. We actually talk about it.
Yeah.
Every few weeks or so, you know, and how is MPW, because I'm wondering, how is MPW going to pay their next dividend? And I'm just wondering if they have a fleet of cars that they can get a title loan at a pawn shop.
I mean, well, it's funny you should say that, because the next dividend payment is tomorrow, as fate would have it. And look, like, you know, I think people generally know how I feel about this company, or forget what how I feel about it, like what this company observably does. And just this morning, for example, they put out a press release. So like this is the backdoor, like, our liquidity is fine press release, to my mind. Mike, you know what I'm talking about, where like you kind of it's the liquidity, our liquidity is fine, but the backdoor disclosure that it's not fine. So you, like, later on you could say, oh well, we let everybody know it was getting ugly, even though that's not what it said. So if you go through their release this morning, like, Mike, you know this, like, I track this really closely, and I think I sent you my note actually, but if you track all the puts and takes, it implies something like $200 million of cash burn at MPW over the last 2 months. I mean, it is a remarkable amount of cash burn. I've never seen anything like it. And
you mean the cash burn is loans that are going into a black hole that they will never get cash burn?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it's taking various forms, right? Like, so last quarter, for example, I think that, like, this is just a theory, but my thought is that the guys at MPW understand now that there's so many eyes on this that they just can't fund their operators the way they used to. And so what they literally did in the quarter during 2Q, they actually received rent from Steward and wired it back before quarter end, and basically treated it as an accounts receivable bill. So like, if you think about what that means, that's a loan. But what they did was they shifted it up from the investing section of the cash flow statement to the operating section, and then didn't talk about it on the call, didn't put it in the earnings release, didn't put it in the supplemental. And it's not until the Q comes out like 7 or 8 days later that you see it. Subsequent to that, you know, like you're ticking away at $100 million of cash burn per quarter, which means almost definitionally they're doing more of that. I mean, look, like, I hate, you know, you hate making inflammatory statements, but like, they are on the glide path to running out of money.
Well, and just for you, the investors out there, to know, on MPW, 100% they cannot refinance the $1.4 billion in loans that they have that come due in 1Q25.
That's the bogey. Yeah, that's the nut.
Yeah, that which is trading, I haven't looked at it recently, but it's trading deep into the double digits of yield right now.
Yeah.
And their origination is in the low single digits. And so nobody will ever refinance that for them.
Somebody,
they're going to fall on that.
So somebody, but this is an interesting one on that point. So, like, you know, REITs are just capital allocators, right? And, you know, it's a very delicate balance that they walk, because they actually have to distribute under REIT rules. Like, there's a limitation of how much capital you can retain. So MPW earlier in the quarter cut its dividend by half. And if you think about what that means, like that's value that they're retaining that should like accrue to the bondholders. Well, the spreads on their, I'm not talking about yields, I'm talking about spreads on their bonds widened by 300 or 400 basis points over the next 2 weeks after a dividend cut. Like that is telling you that this thing is dead. Like it's in the process of dying.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, 40% of their tenants are flat out insolvent.
Yes.
And at least. So the amount of loans that they have out to them is astonishing to such a degree that they become the owners of the insolvent companies when in bankruptcy. You know, the debt holders become the owners. And so you, and then you violate all your REIT rules, and now you're a hospital operator instead of a hospital property operator.
Yep. Right. Exactly.
Hey, look, in short, we've never been stronger. We've never been more secure. I mean, they literally sound like the guys at Enron. Just me.
Yeah.
Or Bear Stearns. That's what they sound like. Bear Stearns.
Our liquidity is strong, right? Like that's the
our line. Liquidity, they brought Ace Greenberg Ace out there and they were like, hey, your liquidity has never been better. Now get my oxygen mask.
So Mike, you'll appreciate this. This morning a guy told me this is one of the funds that like ARPs the cap stack. They're not just thinking about the equity. They said that the offer on 5-year CDS quoted to them today was 1,100 basis points. Like, think about that number. Like, that is a strikingly scary number.
That's a great deal.
I know, right here and now, right? But it was the problem is it was 400 basis points like 3 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
That's the problem.
That's a great deal. You could 4x your return.
Yeah, right. That's true. I'm thinking in relatives.
That's on the dollar. There you go.
That's true. That's very fair. Anyway, I don't want to hog all the space. I'll shut up. But thanks. Thanks for the kind words, Mike. And I just wanted to say hello. So I'll put myself on mute.
Rob, no, I'm sorry. It is just quickly in terms of, you know, so Jordan, I don't know if you heard that question in terms of asking, like, how do you find opportunities or source kind of, you know, just from a research standpoint. Would you mind maybe just giving, you know, brief, again, you don't have to give your secret sauce, obviously, but
yeah,
and you and I are going to, you know, again, I'm going to be, you've got your sector show launching next Wednesday, I believe it is. Next Thursday morning. And so you and I, you know, I'll be kind of your sidekick on those moving forward, which I'm very excited about. So, you know, we'll be able to kind of expand upon the, you know, your process and a lot of different things that are happening within the real estate world. But do you mind just kind of giving Jordan a little bit of a rundown?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the simple answer is that it's like, it's really an art and not a science. So at a base level, first of all, like, you know, like all of us, it's kind of a one-man show on the REIT team at this point. And I have, you know, 200 some odd equity REITs that I could theoretically look at any given point in time. So what I actually start with is the macro, and I use the quad outlook as kind of like my narrowing of the funnel. So like imagine a funnel at the wide end, there's like, you know, 200 some odd REITs floating at the top. And I think about the macro and the quad framework and you know, kind of like what our outlook is over the next 12 months to narrow a selection of those names at the bottom, like narrow end of the funnel, and then dig into each one of them to try to like find both longs and shorts against the macro. Like, well, actually, MPW is a good example of that. Like, theoretically, you would expect a quote-unquote healthcare REIT, even though that's not really what they are, to be an outperformer in a quad four, which we just kind of went through. And it's really fun to, like, it's fun to find names that, for idiosyncratic reasons, like, should buck the macro, because that's real alpha, right? Like, that's not like a trend trade. That's like where you're finding something that's like different. And the way I do that, I have a very, very different. So this is a little bit of secret sauce, but like I've talked about it. It's not proprietary or anything like that. I think it's just different. When I dig into a company, I start with a proxy. And that's kind of like a weird, I mean, Mike, by the way, I'd love to know your thoughts on that. But like, it's a weird place to start. Usually folks will like, you know, bust open a 10K or read an earnings call. But the proxy to me, like, really kind of lays the framework and the groundwork for what the incentives are. And I find that, like, when I understand the management team's incentives and how it's structured, I could kind of, like, imagine in my own mind where the puck is going as opposed to where it's been. But yeah, so, like, for example, in the case of FDW, I'm just going to use an example. They have this really perverse comp plan mechanism where part of their unit payout is determined by the dollar value of acquisitions that they execute every year. And if that's not appropriately modified, that's actually, like, a really, like, bad thing, because you're basically incentivizing the management team, or, you know, they're incentivizing themselves to go out and buy anything, like be an asset aggregator. And not just that, but to pay the highest price. And so, like, when I saw that, for example, I kind of knew in my mind's eye, like, where this was going to go. It was just, then it's just a question of time and what the capital structure looks like. And, like, and then it kind of gives you almost like a roadmap to dig into different areas. So that's where I start. Then I go into, like, the traditional analysis of modeling the company and, like, trying to understand the tenants and, you know, going through all the earnings calls, et cetera, et cetera. And like Mike said, just reading, listening, taking notes repeatedly over and over and over again.
Yeah, Rob. Yeah, that was, Rob, that you certainly opened my eyes to the proxy, especially in the real estate world. And when you showed me that on FDW, I just... it really blew my mind, because again, you're incentivizing them to not only do an acquisition, but certainly, you know, be the winner of that acquisition regardless of price, which I thought was just a glaringly obvious component. And just expand, you know, for anybody listening in who's interested in learning more about Rob's process, there's if you go to the HedgEye YouTube channel, there's a playlist there, a series called Sector Head Spotlight, where I actually sat down with a number of our different sector heads and walk through kind of their background and their process. And, you know, Rob, you were kind enough to kind of do a deeper dive into how you review proxies and stuff like that. So if anybody's interested, by all means, that's all free. It's on the site. Go give HedgEye a follow or subscribe, whatever it is on YouTube. And then, yeah, one last thing, Jordan, again, you know, not to keep kind of stealing your thunder, but the another way, you know, one of the, again, just a kind of plug HedgEye, I guess, here at the end, is one way of kind of trying to source through a lot of different ideas is to lean on our research team, right? On our sector heads. We have, what is it, Rob? Over three, I think it's like 350, might even be up to 400 different, you know, pieces of inventory or tickers that
yeah,
are inside of our general universe. And that's a great way of, you know, especially if you're not doing this full time, like Rob, myself, or Mike and many others that are listening in. You know, if you need to lean on somebody to help kind of navigate both the good and the bad out there, you know, this, you know, HedgEye is a great source of great source for that. So just want to kind of plug that too, Jordan.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I mean, you guys do amazing research, and I've been a follower since I think 2018 is when I first started.
Oh, amazing.
Subscribing to HedgEye. Like, just so I've been seeing a lot of great calls and a lot of great risk management. So I really appreciate it.
Awesome, bud. Well, Mike, I just want to, again, oh, sorry, Ron.
I got to drop off, so I'll, nope. Thanks a lot for having me up here. Be well, Mike. Be well, Rob. And
Thank you.
A good one, man. See you later, guys.
Yeah, Mike, I just wanted to thank you. It's been a pleasure, as always, and
appreciate
your time. I know you were kind enough to sit down with some professionals last week, some advisors and stuff, so wanted to thank you for that as well. You're always a great member of the community. Troglodytes unite, HedgEye Nation unite. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Have a great day. Good luck out.
Yep. Thank you. Cheers, everyone. We'll see you Thursday, not Wednesday, but Thursday. We'll do something Thursday, boys and girls. See y'all then. Look for a tweet and I'll kind of update my schedule and stuff like that. Cheers, everyone.
Don't forget to check out HedgEye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @HedgEye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by HedgEye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable.
Hedgeye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the contents. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the Terms of Service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.